Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. I'm your host, Dr. Dave O'Brien from Goldsmiths, University of London. On this episode, I'll be talking to Dr. Zoe Thompson from Leeds Beckett University about her new book, Urban Constellations, Spaces of Cultural Regeneration in Post-Industrial Britain. Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. On this episode, I'll be talking to Zoe Thompson, who is a senior lecturer in cultural studies at Leeds Beckett University. And we'll be talking about her new book, Urban Constellations, Spaces of Cultural Regeneration in Post-Industrial Britain. So welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me, Dave.
Urban Constellations is a book that sort of tries to combine some case studies about contemporary regeneration projects, particularly cultural regeneration projects, and some really interesting critical theoretical interventions. And I wonder if you could sort of tell the listeners a bit about how you came to write the book and what your sort of background was that led you to write the book. I know you say at the start that it was the culmination of a kind of a 5-year research project.
Yeah. Well, the book actually comes out of my PhD research. And I suppose my background to that is that I'm from the Northeast originally. And then I went to Salford to do my first degree in sociology as a mature student in the mid-90s. And so I arrived in Manchester just weeks after the IRA bomb that kind of destroyed parts of the city and had, you know, sort of started off a regeneration project in the city. So I did sociology at Salford, and there that's where I first encountered a lot of the ideas that came to form the basis for the book. So I was taught by people like Paul Taylor, Brian Longhurst, and most importantly, Graham Gillick, who's a sort of a specialist in Walter Benjamin. So he was also the first person to introduce me to Baudrillard. As I completed my undergrad dissertation on the theme of the body in Baudrillard's work. And I think Graham Gillick always encouraged me to take him both sort of more and less seriously. So as both kind of a Dornian worst case scenario critic, and also as a kind of playful provocateur. And I think, you know, that's where my sort of interest in that kind of theory started. Interestingly enough, actually, Graham didn't teach any Benjamin as to undergrads. So it was later that I came to his work. So then after I graduated, I worked for a couple of years, during which I completed an MA in cultural studies at what was then Leeds Met, and I did that part-time. And there I encountered Will Merrin, who was another Baudrillard specialist, and Ross Abinett, who is sort of specialist in continental philosophy and postmodern thinkers. And I'd already decided that I did want to go into academia and do a PhD, so I kind of ran the funding gauntlet and ended up at the University of Birmingham, where I was a graduate teaching assistant, and I completed an MA in social research there with them, and then my PhD, which was AHRC funded. And that's where the book sort of starts, really, in the sense of it's out of that PhD project that the book emerges. So, so that it was the sort of concentration of being in different northern cities and this sort of being interested in the sort of critical repertoire of Benjamin and Baudrillard, and trying to put those two things together, that was the sort of catalyst to that project, really. And then after I finished the PhD, I worked on an NIHR health research project based between the NHS and the Universities of Leeds and York. And then I've been at Leeds Beckett since 2012 in the School of Cultural Studies. So it was around ideas about urban change, transformations of post-industrial cities, that's sort of been my abiding interest, really.
And this has been a major kind of academic, but also practical question that's really kind of been something that cities around the world have had to deal with. So, you know, it's not a peculiarly kind of British phenomenon to see cultural organisations and specifically cultural buildings used to kind of change places. And you use 4 examples, which the Lowry in Salford, which is a kind of city that's sort of next door to Manchester, but has been absorbed into Manchester. The Deep in Hull, which Hull is a kind of smaller northern city on the north coast of the UK, but it will be UK City of Culture in 3 years' time, I think.
Yes, 2017, I think it is.
2017. The Sage in Gateshead, which is the kind of the other side of the river to Newcastle, which is a city in the northeast, then the public in West Brom, which is a place just outside Birmingham. And so in many ways, there are kind of, you know, these are big towns, big cities, but they're also, they've got these kind of interesting bigger places that they're kind of part of.
Yeah, and it was important, actually, that they weren't the most important sites. So in a sense, you know, it's important to me in terms of the rationale of the project and also the kind of theory of the sort of Benjamin's notion of the minor and the overlooked and the sort of neglected, that it wasn't Manchester, that it was Salford rather than Manchester, that it was Gateshead rather than Newcastle, and so on and so forth, because actually the stakes are higher in a way for those sites. Because their sort of sister towns or cities close by have always had a kind of greater capacity to transform and a greater kind of you know, historically their fortunes have been different. So it was important actually that there were these more minor sites as well, and also mostly importantly that it wasn't that I wasn't trying to read out off these case studies from the capital, from the position of the capital of London, where we could, you know, you could literally just turn around and find one everywhere you looked. So yeah, there was definitely a privileging of the minor going on in the choice, really.
Yeah, and I suppose the kind of the stakes are almost kind of higher for these minor or maybe more peripheral places, because to an extent, you know, they kind of they gamble quite heavily on these cultural buildings for a variety of, in some ways, you know, kind of rational or, you know, kind of hopeful or optimistic projects. But in other ways, you know, really kind of fantastic in, you know, the kind of fantasy sense of the term.
Sure.
Ways of sort of changing themselves.
Absolutely. Yeah. So that was important that there were these more peripheral sites and as well as that, you know, it was about the fact that they were all funded by public money, so that it was national lottery money that was one of the chosen criteria that they were funded through. And that obviously they were staging arts or culture in some way. So it did rule out other contenders, you know, like, for example, the Eden Project, Warsaw Art Gallery, Urbis, the Baltic. So that then created a kind of pool of case studies to choose from. Go on.
No, and it's interesting you mentioned the lottery funding, because it's something that the case studies kind of bookend the sort of era of a particular kind of urban regeneration in the UK that really stopped with certainly 2010, but really kind of stopped with the financial crisis and the sense of, you know, public spending being able to build, you know, brilliant new buildings that would somehow transform urban spaces. Well, that money just isn't there anymore. It's not something that the public seem to be committing to.
Absolutely. And I think it's interesting in a way that it's certainly, that's when I was coming to write the book, that it felt like the right moment, because there was this sort of flourishing of a very short period, really, in sort of British culture around these sorts of projects, you know, marked possibly by the sort of, you know, the end of the 90s, the sort of millennial optimism, and then, as you say, the sort of financial crash. But interestingly, like the building, like the public, which sort of already falls out of love with that mode of regeneration, sort of prior to the financial crash, which sort of adds an interesting layer of, on the one hand, the sort of economic circumstances that produce these buildings, but also the kind of waning of that towards the sort of, you know, late 2000s, when actually the sort of the ability for them to actually do the job that everyone hopes they'll do is starting to become a bit sort of questioned and questionable.
And it's interesting the kind of we touched on this idea of, you know, those buildings being there to do particular jobs, and, you know, the kind of fantastical elements, and you use this term to kind of describe all of them, which I think is quite interesting. You call them dream houses. I wonder if you could sort of say a bit about that term and where it comes from, why you thought it was useful.
Yeah, well, this is a term that comes from Benjamin's Arcades project, which is his kind of unfinished magnum opus that he writes about the city in the 30s. And he counted among the sort of 19th century dream houses when he's looking at Paris, buildings such as the arcades, railway station, the winter gardens. And these were sort of new structures that began to appear in the urban centres of modernity that were sort of a triumph of technology and innovation over nature. So the sort of arcades turned the street into an interior. The railway stations were hubs that transformed space and time through rail travel. You know, the winter gardens beat climate restrictions through their heating and made tropical plants available for visitors all year round. And I suppose we could think of sort of, in the British context, you could think of a building like Crystal Palace, a sort of famous British dream house, a glass and iron marvel, a feat of engineering. And for Benjamin, that was both a kind of showcase of the spoils of the British Empire at the World Fair and also a place where audiences were first trained to look at commodities and sort of trained to become consumers. So for him, the notion of the dream house is about the way in which buildings carry within them sort of both the utopian promise and the failure of a particular historical period in which they were conceived. So when they're examined, either at their inception, which is what I'm trying to do here with these buildings, or as Benjamin did in the early 20th century when they're on the verge of ruin, he argued it's possible to sort of make visible these promises and these hopes and dreams of the society and culture that produced them. So that's where the term dream house comes from. And I thought this was a really fitting way to actually think about these recent projects of cultural regeneration in the UK, particularly the projects conceived and built around the millennium, because at the moment of their inception, they were filled with the sort of promises and dreams of transformation for their locations. I mean, I didn't quite expect to have to be able to exist in a ruin so soon, you know, with the public. So, but I'm arguing, I think, in the book that the buildings I look at are the sort of latest version of this phenomenon that Benjamin noticed in the 1930s.
Benjamin is clearly really, really important to the book. You know, he's a central figure. In the text, and the other kind of key thinker is Jean Baudrillard, kind of high priest of postmodernism and hyperreality and these kind of ideas. And I wonder if you could say a bit about why those two thinkers are important and the role they play in your analysis of the four case studies.
Sure. I mean, I think what's important about them both is the subtlety of their thought on the urban, really. I mean, both thinkers pay attention to the kind of surfaces of the city, and they're also both concerned with the technical transformations of the image and how that then translates into the spatial organisation of cities, really. So architecture as a media form, if you like, is a way that they offer us something new and novel about understanding the urban. So I think if we take Benjamin first, I've already mentioned that he, through the concept of the dream house, he kind of offers up a way to think through some of the promises and the failures of modernity. So through the notion of the messianic, which I trace throughout the book, is where the political lies in his work, I would argue, what I call the kind of hopeless hopefulness. Because the messianic is the yet to come, the promise that's still to be discharged at a future point, a kind of generational responsibility. And I think that's a useful way to understand these projects because of this. They were on the one hand heralded and celebrated, and on the other hand, they kind of perhaps offer up a more dubious or commodified experience of culture. But their success, nonetheless, is still vitally important to the locales that they're in. So they can't fail. And yet, on the other hand, we might question the experience that they end up producing. And I think Baudrillard is, as I mentioned earlier, a kind of provocateur. He's a kind of offers a he challenges us to accept that much of contemporary life is concerned with surface aesthetics, with illusion, with a kind of seduction of empty gestures. But through a sort of these ironical readings, he allows us to disturb these shiny surfaces and see them differently rather than swallow their rhetoric. So I think the two together, the irony on the one hand disturbing the surface and the messianic, which offers a kind of fragile rupture to the surface, opens up a critical purchase on the structures. So the two together, I think, are important because without the one, without the other, is a kind of falling into nihilism on the one hand with Baudrillard, or a kind of a sort of an inability to examine, because of the time that he's writing, the transformations of the aesthetic realm that he examines actually ends up, for Benjamin at least, because it's trying to get them to work together to produce this reading. So this kind of moving between the two, I think, opens up these kind of tiny chinks in the surface that we can kind of then redeem the spaces through. And that's what I'm looking to do all the way through the book, really, is find the moments of redemption where they're rescued from themselves in a way.
The other thing to kind of develop from that is the different kind of economy you're interested in, and you attempt to apply these kind of paradoxical but potentially redemptive figures to, and that comes in the difference between the kind of political economy of buildings, which you say, you know, is there but you're not especially interested in, and then the symbolic economy of urban spaces. And I wonder if you could say both, you know, why it's important to study the symbolic economy and how that might be different from, say, a political economy approach.
Well, I mean, the political economy is there, but as you're right to say, that I'm foregrounding the symbolic economy. I suppose I'm wanting to take the cityscape as a phenomenon, as a surface to be read and experienced. So both its kind of textual qualities, the way in which these buildings are kind of stamped onto the landscape, but also the way in which it produces an embodied response. So I'm interested in how the buildings, and as we encounter the buildings, they make their marks on the landscape, but they also produce an effect. So we encounter them sort of as both visually and in an embodied way. So it was about starting with the building and taking it as, you know, at first sight, if you like, and working backwards from that, peeling off its layers or disturbing its surface, depending on which concept we use. The political economy stuff is important, that it's still important, but I wanted to start with how we first encounter spaces as individuals. And the symbolic economy is important because it's the way in which, on top of the sort of economic organisation of space, we have this kind of, this other layer, what we might call a kind of mythology of the city. And some of the ways in which that works is, if we think about things, the way in which signs and street names and dialects create the city as, in Benjamin's terms, a linguistic cosmos. So this then opens up the possibility of understanding how places are then both real and imagined, which is sort of straightforward political economy reading doesn't offer, in a sense. So in that way, architecture is evidence of that real and imagined notion of the urban, which we can't quite get at through a more conventional economic analysis. So I suppose it's a more, what I would call a psychogeographical starting point that pays attention to the symbolic elements, both, but also the visual and the embodied.
Yeah, and these elements of real and imagined, and the visual are really kind of present in the first case study, which is the Lowry in Salford, where you begin from a particular painting by Lowry that, you know, kind of captures people going to a football match, and then kind of move through a variety of different reflections on the building to make an argument about how the building is at once a kind of very problematic intervention into urban regeneration, but also might have a redemptive and almost kind of collective notion of art and culture behind it.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, from the start, the Lowry has this kind of awkward juxtaposition between the centre itself and the stuff that's in there. So the fact is that Lowry's art was never actually intended for the centre. It just so happened that Salford had the archive, and they were able to move it into the building. So it's evident when you walk through that space that the galleries are kind of tacked on. There's a kind of added on feel to them. So there's this curious sort of sense in which the building's named after him, but he wasn't there at the start, if you like. Nonetheless, the presence of his art, I'm arguing in the book, works to redeem the space away from that notion of an empty site of corporate culture, because it makes visible the various chinks. So, you know, between the past and present urban life, you know, his crowd scenes sort of point to another version of urban life, a kind of collective effervescence. And I think it's important that the centre then can reignite that possibility for visitors and to kind of show the discrepancies between then and now, not in a nostalgic way. And I think that's the problem for me with the Oasis video. I find that their video for the master plan they accept a caricatured version of Lowry's art in their video, and they want to merely slot themselves into it and all of the associations with working class northernness that they kind of play to. But that's not what Lowry's doing. And I think he's misunderstood as an artist of nostalgia, really. The cities that Lowry paints are not painted with a nostalgic eye, but rather a critical eye. So his eye goes to the urban oddities, to the figures, the sameness and the difference, the sort of institutions of working class culture, the church, the football ground, the factory. And because those images are on the wall in the centre, we look out to a very different landscape. And I think it prompts visitors then to ask those questions about class, about who comes to the centre, about where are the working class now, who is the centre for. So he becomes this kind of destructive character in a way. He wasn't meant to be there, but that actually he ends up being the thing that, or his art at least, ends up being the thing that prevents the centre from a kind of straightforward, commodified culture approach.
Now, in a way, the second case study, The Deep in Hull, it is in some ways completely different. And I found the starting point quite interesting as well, because to an extent you go straight for the gift shop and kind of begin your analysis there. And The Deep also as being, a kind of clearly a cultural space, but not a cultural space in the way that we'd view a sort of, a traditional art gallery or concert hall.
Yeah, I do start in the gift shop. This privileging of the minor. So I start with the snow globe, the kind of, in a way, the most insignificant moment in the building, or the most insignificant sort of throwaway disposable souvenir. Souvenir itself from the French means to look again, to see again. And actually, when we do that with the snow globe, it becomes this tool, this kind of philosophical toy that we can then see more of the building. So it actually reveals more than it appears at first glance, just as the building itself of The Deep does, and in fact all the other buildings. So the gift shop, starting in the gift shop, it's brimming with treasures. It's the last place you go to on your way out of the building. There's fluffy toys and models and keyrings. And then when you start to look more closely at them, you realise, they're all made in China. And then that sort of prompts this thinking about, ecological impact on the globe of the container shipping that would have been needed to get all of that stuff over to Hull, and the fossil fuels that are burned to create them, the workers in China who produce the items, pollution and the impact on the environment, global warming. And we see this kind of commodification of nature in the very site that seeks to preserve it. So in that way, these kind of contradictions of the building are revealed. And I think none more so than the point at which, visitors to the centre, which you're right, is not the kind of usual cultural venue, but nature becomes this kind of, nature is commodified, if you like, for our viewing pleasure. And I argue there's a kind of filmic quality to the space and the way that it displays the fish and the other creatures in there. But perhaps, one of the moments that's most sort of provocative is when diners can go on a Friday night, I think it is, and you can sit and look into the tank of The Deep in the restaurant and eat fish and watch fish. And I think I read it as a kind of this uncanny encounter between nature and culture in the kind of Freudian sense, this sort of, the return of the repressed. So there's very much a sort of an uneasy alliance here between our experience of nature and the way in which nature is having to be exploited in order for The Deep to exist.
Your third case study, I guess, is similar and different again, because you focus, when you're thinking about the Sage in Gateshead, on the question of memory. And you have quite an active and sort of personalized role in the chapter because of the methods you adopt of kind of essentially sort of thinking through your experience of walking around the center. So I wonder if you could say a little bit about your methods and the relationship between ideas about individual and collective memory and the kind of broader regeneration projects that, in fact, all of these case studies are part of.
Well, I use walking methods throughout the case studies, but I think, I'm taking the idea of the flaneur and adapting that visual and embodied figure through the spaces that's coming out of sort of Benjamin's work. But it's most explicit, I think, in the chapter on the sage. And that's partly possibly because there's an encounter in that chapter with my own past, given that I'm from the Northeast and I have family connection to the site. So I think in both Baudrillard and Benjamin experiment at various points in their careers with sort of autobiography and memoir in an attempt to kind of produce these subjective responses to places. So there's kind of playing with those ideas in that chapter. And I argue that, you know, our responses to these buildings are both universal and also highly particular. So, you know, the very fact that I'm from that area inevitably will take me back into my past and take me back into what was there before. And it so happens that then brings up sort of memories of my family, etc. So in a sense, walking around the site and then also the views that the building stages for visitors to it, casts a magnificent view out across the Tyne, across the Tyne Bridge and around that area. And at the same time, is it kind of the sage covers over what was there before and the elements of old gates that I'm discussing as being connected to my past and my family's past. At the same time, it kind of simultaneously evokes those moments because this kind of notion of memory on foot as I walk around the places. So there's a sense in which the building becomes this aperture into the past for me that redeems it from just being a kind of spaceship that's crash landed on the site. And I expect that most of the buildings could provoke this response for people who were local to them. Clearly, my response to the sage is going to be different, perhaps, Dave, from yours. But I think that it's important to register those local effects and those subjective responses, because I think that's where that embodied sense is felt, actually, when we encounter these spaces.
The final case study... I think it might be worth dwelling on for a little bit because it captures, I guess, the kind of the hidden risks that underpin the other three case studies, a story about, in some ways, you know, the kind of the failure of how these cultural buildings can be used to regenerate places. I'm thinking in particular how both the Lowry, the Deep and the Sage, you have to read in, I think, quite kind of interesting and provocative ways in order to open them up to critique. Whereas the Public in West Bromwich, there's a really straightforward story of here is a building that kind of closed before it opened. So I wonder if you could say actually a little bit of detail about the story behind the Public and then talk about what it might mean as a premature ruin.
Well, I mean, in a way, we're ending on the saddest note, in a sense, which, you know, the campaign to save the Public was lost at the end of 2013, and I think it will be turned into a sixth form college. But when I began this project in 2005, the building was already halted, so it had run out of money, and it was this kind of, you know, this kind of forlorn, empty shell. So it was already ruined before it was finished, and it prompted me to think through what that might mean. As the research sort of progressed, the project was beset by a number of setbacks and failures and halts, and eventually it stuttered open, but only to sort of see the technology in its galleries fail and then it have to be closed again. So there's this kind of endless sort of deferral in a sort of Derridean terms, or what I would like to sort of claim for it is a kind of messianic cessation in Benjamin's terms. So these fits and starts, I think, start to raise questions about its rationale and the rationale of these big projects. So it was meant to be built for this kind of peripatetic arts group called the Public. And then as the money sort of spiraled out of control, they were all made redundant. It ended up costing more, but I think the figure, it spiraled from 40 to 53 million pounds of public money, of course. And then it also prompts the question of the notion of these kind of starchitects, these kind of famous architects who are sort of brought in to build these spectacular buildings, because Will Alsop, who was the original architect, didn't end up finishing the project. And then when its galleries broke, the whole notion of the fact that the building itself didn't really have anything in it, it was there for the public to make their own art, started to, you know, raise questions about who is this for and what is this project for? And actually, what can we expect from such a project? How does it translate to the local communities for whom it's intended, but who then don't recognise it, don't feel that ownership and that sense of connectedness to it? So I think that notion of the premature ruin and the ill-fatedness of the building allows for an interrogation of sort of important questions about public engagement with culture and what that might mean. And it's certainly not to celebrate the ruin. In a sense, it's to use the story of that building to ask very sober questions about who and what it was for, really, and the ability that these projects have to actually transform their locales for the better. So I think, you know, its setbacks also, as we've discussed earlier, did signal ahead of the financial crisis a kind of collective weariness with that cultural regen formula. You know, the big building, famous architect, post-industrial site, a kind of cultural ennui with this sort of project. And so rather than a kind of economically deterministic, there's no money for this kind of thing anymore, blah, blah, actually the fatigue with that idea was already present in the public. So I think it's actually a really important, if we redeem anything from that premature ruin, it is asking those questions about the ethics of these buildings, really.
And the book concludes by sort of being quite open and honest about the ambivalence of the analysis, but that ambivalence carries through into the idea that it's probably still better for these spaces to exist than for them to not exist. And this manifested itself in, and I might have sort of slightly misread this, but in the idea that kind of in this analysis, Benjamin beats Baudrillard, as it were, that his version of kind of critique and ambivalence is kind of, if not better, but more appropriate than Baudrillard. And I wonder if you could kind of talk through the book's ambivalent conclusion and how those two thinkers struggle in that conclusion.
Yeah, I think it does. I do end on an ambivalent note, but I do still think it's better that they exist. The intention was never to kind of, was always to be critical of this sort of latest mode of urban change, but was never to be, sneering from the sidelines at these projects, because they are very important. They're vitally important for the areas that they exist in for all kinds of reasons, not least economic. And I think that, in the end, it does come down to a leap of faith and the kind of the fragility of Benjamin's reading still allows that possibility of political transformation, even though it is weak and even though it is fragile. And I think that whilst Baudrillard's is a moral position, there's no doubt that he takes seriously what he says, and he possibly believes that his position is the most moral. It's not a political position. His version of the event without precedent, that which arises from which we couldn't predict, that he sort of he terms the symbolic as against the simulation of the sort of image producing societies, cannot be willed. It cannot be organized for, and it cannot be willed. And I think that for me, that is just a place that Benjamin allows us to step back from and accept some of the truth of that, but actually also still wait for that possibility of transformation. And so I suppose I end with a kind of a notion that Baudrillard's sort of he's a kind of hopeless hopelessness rather than Benjamin's hopeless hopefulness. There's a sliver of difference, but it's important that it's there.
I wonder, I mean, the book obviously has come up very, very recently. But I wonder, where are you sort of moving forward with this kind of work? Are you going to be doing some more stuff around questions of culture and regeneration and urban space, or are you thinking about another project within cultural studies?
I'm still interested in ideas of urban change and space and place, and I'm still interested in those kind of apparently minor moments of transformation that produce an understanding of sort of belonging and attachment to place. I've recently been working on a project with two other colleagues. We got some money for a project entitled Media and Place, which focuses on West Yorkshire. And there are various projects in as part of the bid. And we're looking at public engagement with sculpture at Yorkshire Sculpture Park, with urban guerrilla gardening in Leeds, rhubarb and Yorkshire identity, media tourism to home Firth, and tourism practices across the region. So it kind of, this project, Media and Place, notes this sort of shift in cultural studies away from the merely representational, and it uses, all of the projects use walking interviews. So I'm taking that method with me from the book, if you like, and from that previous work, to think through some of the more embodied practices of place as well as the cultural representations.
Sounds really, really interesting. Thanks for listening to New Books in Critical Theory. I've been your host, Dr. Dave O'Brien. On this episode, I was talking to Dr. Zoe Thompson from Leeds Beckett University about her new book, Urban Constellations, Spaces of Cultural Regeneration in Post-Industrial Britain.